You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
Wow, I love this podcast. It's with Khalifa Oliver. She is an international experience coach, executive advisor, keynote speaker, author, and expert on building brilliant experiences using people-centered design and analytics. Dr. Oliver has her PhD in industrial organizational psychology from Clemson University and her certification in people analytics from MIT. And her new book is called I Think I Love My Job, Secrets to Designing a People-Centered Employer Value Propositions that you can actually boast about. Khalifa got recommended to me from my friend Steve, former colleague here at Second City, and I said yes and to the conversation, and I'm so glad I did, and you're going to be glad too. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Khalifa Oliver, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
There's a line in the introduction of your book that reads, quote, I have had the privilege of having a seat at the table, but I have also had to sit outside of the door, end quote. So this is what I would refer to as a both and statement, which means it is both something that is interesting and provocative and good and something that is the opposite. Is that correct?
Yes, right. I think often when we think about how people get to where they get to, and how they've learned things, we always try to tell the rosy story, right? Like, I worked really hard, I got the seat at the table. But even at those levels, even as you work, you always have to remember there will be times where you are sitting outside the door, right? And you have to decide if you are able to have the impact outside the door or not, right? Even if it's just through listening and waiting on people to walk out the door to have those conversations with them at that time. So it's understanding that your position will not always be a place of privilege. It will not always be inside the room. And there will be times that you will be humbled into having to sit outside that room and try to figure out if that's the place that you need to be and if you need to make a change.
Yeah, and I don't want to glorify a lack of privilege, but the social scientists have shown that often when you're in that position, you see things more clearly for what they are.
Yeah, you get to see the whole picture, right? Because it's easy, and I tell that to people sometimes, it is easy to be in the room and fall into groupthink, right? Because you believe that once you're in the room, you're also trying to stay in the room. And often staying in the room makes you feel like you need to agree, right? And so it is a very tough place to be as the constant devil's advocate. Because you often can be seen as a troublemaker. So being a devil's advocate means that you also have to build a lot of trust with the people in the room, right? And you also have to figure out when are you being a devil's advocate and when are you just being provocative just for the sake of it. And if you don't think that your devil's advocacy is going to help you have an impact, then maybe you don't be a devil's advocate. But sometimes being outside the room allows you to see all the people who walked in the room, all the people who walked out of the room, and also what could I have said in that room that might have made that difference the next time. So it allows you to kind of see it from multiple angles. And so humility will do that for you too. Humility will do that for you as well when you are sitting down outside of the room.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a quality that I think you and I share, and it's a little bit of a superpower, which is I think we're both very good at sound bites. So I have a line in my talks, and I gave one earlier this week on Monday, where I say that improvisation is yoga for your social skills. And a lot of people are not like, oh, that's
And amazing. I'm stealing it, just so you know.
So, but then later in the Q&A, some guy goes, so which kind of yoga? And he starts naming them. I'm like, you're ruining my soundbite. I don't know enough about yoga. So I'm going to pull out one of yours, not as a gotcha, but as one that I think is really smart and one we should talk about. You say, quote, you want to know the biggest difference between executive leaders and toddlers? Toddlers ask more questions.
Yes. And it's one of my favorite things to say. It's true. And it's so my children are currently 4, 7, and 9. I got to get it right so that if they don't hear this later, they don't get mad at me.
Yeah.
And, you know, so they're close in age and they're preschoolers and they're toddlers. And if you've ever been around a toddler, they just ask questions. And at the same time that I have these toddlers, I am also dealing with executives at the same time. And then you start, and this is so funny to say, but then you start realizing the similarity between these two groups of people. Mm-hmm. You have to think ahead for toddlers, because you know when they ask that first question, they are not going to stop until they understand. They want you to simplify that thing to where it makes sense. 1 and 1 equals 2, and it makes absolute sense. Leaders and executives are similar, except they don't ask as many questions because they don't feel comfortable and safe in many ways to say they don't know or they don't understand things, right? And that's one of the things I've encountered with a lot of executives and data. Many executives are not as data savvy as they think they are, or they pretend to be, because we have put, and this is sometimes unfair, we've put this burden on them to know everything about everything, which includes data. And so you go in and, you know, you nerd up and you give this data rich speech and they're like, okay. The difference is a toddler will say, I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
I don't know what that means. Tell me more. Right. And they will keep going. You have to think like that when you're making any sort of presentation to an executive, especially when it's something that is out of their wheelhouse. They are looking at everything. You are looking at this one thing. It is more salient to you than it is to them. And in that room, I tell people, executives and leaders let you in the room because you are the authority on that thing. You are not the authority on everything, but that thing that they let you in the room for is what you're there for. And they will not ask as many questions. And they will keep going and ask different people questions until they find the person who's speaking the language they understand. Whereas a toddler will just keep asking you. They'll just keep asking you until they're satisfied. And it's funny with toddlers, when they're done, they're like, oh, and then they leave.
This is such a gargantuan lie. This idea that any single human being can have all the knowledge soup right. to nuts in any organization, I don't remember, I had a past boss is like, you've got to know everything. And I'm like, that is impossible. Do you right. know everything? You don't.
Right.
And so you're starting with a lie that you know everything, and no one knows everything. We are completely reliant on all these people that are the webs of our businesses and we really desperately need them to give us the truth. And yet the incentives are not there for them to give us the truth.
Absolutely. You know, one of my favorite research articles is on the folly of rewarding A when expecting B. One of my favorite articles. And the biggest thing about that article is the idea that we're often thinking we're rewarding a certain type of behavior, but we're actually creating another type of behavior. And so you get the incentive to lie to leaders.
Mm-hmm.
Because one, your aim is to, in your mind, make them feel good and make them feel comfortable, right? And your other incentive is to stay in the room, right? And you don't have to be in every room. If they don't trust you in that room, why do you want to be in that room, right? And so I think that is what it is. It's this incentive we've created for leaders to believe that it is unsafe to say, I don't understand what you're talking about. And some of the best leaders I've worked with, especially when I build a relationship with them, and he wants to say, I don't know what you're talking about. Explain this to me a different way, right? Even with my teams now, when I don't understand what they're talking about, I have learned in the humility of saying, explain this to me like a toddler. I don't know what you're talking about. And those are the people who indicate openness to learn. It also tells you change the language in which you're saying the thing. Because while what you're saying may be smart, I don't understand. So communication isn't happening. So how do you change that? And I think that's the biggest thing. We don't know how to communicate with each other because we've made assumptions about the power dynamic in the room. And often, and this is what people don't know, if you are invited to the room in that moment that they ask you the question, the power is yours in that moment. That's why they asked you the question. And they will go and ask other people. If you can't answer them, they will find somebody to answer them. And some of those people will lie, but they want an answer that they understand. You need to, that power in that moment is yours to just take and run with. And it took me too long in my life to learn that.
Another aspect that is the bedding of this book is this fact that we, in the last 15, 20 years, and probably even before, well, definitely before, but really we've seen the hyperscaling of this idea of this customer-centric approach and personalized for the customer, a thing we never thought we could do. And then you realize, oh no, this is absolutely what we need to do, and we can solve it through technical needs and through algorithms and through other things, and recognizing niches and all of that. And you offer... And you are not alone. This is a theme in the podcast with people who come from neuroscience and CFOs and other places that we need to do the same thing with another kind of customer we have, which is our employees.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's the, it's the weird thing where we know we can see humans as humans, but we can only see them when there's money that seems to be quickly attached to them. Right. And it's not understanding the product of the employee, right? And that's why I tell people the employee experience is a product. So every time people talk about the employee experience, everybody thinks it's warm and fluffy and fuzzy. And I'm like, no, it's an actual product. It's the thing that I'm buying, right? When I put an application into your job, you're selling me a product. The difference is, as a customer, if I walk into Target and I don't like how you treat me, I could walk across the street. I could go to another store. I can give it back, right? I could say, you sold me this product. It is a dud. Give me my money back. I can't do that with a job. Jobs are strong situations. I can't just say, this is not the job you promised me. Take it back. Give me my time back. Give me my money back, right? And I think we don't understand. You can take the same principles if you see your customers as your employees as an element and a resource that helps you with your income, with your business goals.
Sure.
And you take care of it the same way. And you customize and you personalize, you get the best out of people because we understand it fundamentally when they become customers, that we can get the best out of people. We can get them to act. We can change their behavior when we personalize and customize and see them as humans instead of robots and entities. We see them. So where you'll hear people say a lot of times, oh, I'm a customer and they just see me as a number. They don't. The algorithm might see you as a number, but there's a reason why me and a friend could both be on social media. I'm searching for orange dresses. She's searching for purple dresses. And now my feed and her feed at the same time are full of ads with purple dresses versus orange dresses, right? It's because you fundamentally understood that our tastes are different. And while your algorithm sees me as a number, you recognize that they're different elements that made up each of us as a person, as a customer. So why can't we also do that for employees when we have the technology to do it?
So this leads, of course, to an idea around remote work arrangements, which there's a whiplash going on with regard to the last few years with this, because we all had to do it, whether we liked it or not. And our businesses were like, you've got to do this. And we did. And then we figured out in a variety of different ways, and certainly this is the case in the area that I work at Second City, which was the division that I'm sort of based in, we maintained our budget going remote. You know, the theaters didn't. We had to shut those down. Other aspects of the business didn't. But, you know, my live keynotes and my podcast, all of that could keep going. They just turned into a thing that I was doing on the screen that we're on right now. And that sort of said something, I think, that was pretty interesting. And there was I don't like the term work-life balance. I prefer work-life sway, because we're always going in and out of that.
But
we have a place now where these edicts seem to be coming down week after week, which get back in the office. And this does not seem to be data-driven.
It's not. Okay. I can unequivocally say it's not data driven.
Yeah, all right.
All data says the opposite, right?
Because this is two feelings. These are bosses' feelings.
Right. This is the feeling. This is control, and this is economics, right? At the end of the day, it's the idea that there are a lot of people who cannot understand that what you're hiring me for is not my time; it's my skill, right? Yeah. And people can't get away from the idea that it's not my time, it's my skill. Because if you think about the traditional labor force, the factory workers, everything was based on time. Even consultant companies perpetuated that idea, because when I pay you as a consultant, I'm paying you not for the project. I'm paying you, you know, you're paying me hourly, okay. Right? Yeah. So I am telling you my time, it's what is important with as an employee, when all the data is showing that productivity was fine. Productivity went up. There's a little difference in performance. There are people who will abuse the system, just like there are people who are in the office and they're clip-clopping all over with a teacup, not doing any work either, right? So being in person doesn't mean I work any harder or I'm more productive. It also doesn't mean I'm innovative, because innovations did not stop during the pandemic. In fact, many of them blossomed, because people found new ways. That's the beauty of humans, right? People found new ways to come up with new ideas in challenging situations. And so it's not a data-driven decision. It's a feelings decision. There are a lot of people who lead who cannot fathom that work can happen in different places. The other idea is that there are a lot of younger people who've come out, and the conceptualization of working away from people is not new to them. They've grown up building relationships with people remotely their whole life, right? And so, you know, back in the day, if somebody moved away from your city or town, you may not ever hear from them again. That is it. That is the end of your friendship. So I think it's a generational thing to where people can't conceptualize it, but it's a power thing. If I can't see you, I can't control what you're doing. I have to be accountable for your actions, right? And I also need somebody to blame. And it's easier to blame you if you're there, yeah, in front of me. So it's not data-driven at all. The other element of it is some jobs can happen remotely and some jobs can't.
Yes.
And I think when people talk about remote work a lot, we talk about it in the binary, right? And it doesn't work for everybody. There's some people who are more, they love to be around people. There's some who don't. It doesn't have to be in the binary. Remote work happens anyway. I have often worked from home, and I'm spending all my time talking to people in China, and I'm working remotely because yeah. I'm in an office talking to somebody in a different country, right? But what remote work also allows that people don't bring into the equation is for those who have to go into their location, retail employees, theater employees, manufacturing employees, it clears the road for them. It helps them get to work on time. It lowers the cost of time for them. It allows them to have breakfast, right? Like, it creates a space where we are more efficient in how we do work. They can get home quickly. They don't have all the traffic. They don't have issues finding parking because they have to be there. And it meets that balanced need of those who, I don't have to do this and I have to do this, but we don't have that conversation enough.
So this is fascinating because I don't think, all right, this is a connection in real moment that I'm making that maybe is not as important as I think it is, but I'm going to go for it, which is, so the podcast lately, I've been interviewing a bunch of people who talk about the need for the future of work to move away from jobs to skills. More and more, we're looking at the skills-based positions, and that you're sitting here and you've got this, the idea of a job title, the idea of, like, I've worked here 37 years, like, that just doesn't happen in places anymore.
Right, right.
So when you think about that, and then you think about remote work, by changing the focus to where are we doing certain kinds of skill work, which can be done at home or can be done in a certain manner, and where are we doing other kinds of work which require the power of human connection in a room together? Because that's a real thing. There is no question.
Substitute for it, right?
It's not. But they are different kinds of work that happen at different times. So yes, I work in a theater, and if I'm on stage, I'm not doing that. But we're not asking you to be on the stage to take care of your paperwork. Maybe the framing is just all wrong, which is, like, at any given time, look at the skills that make up your job. What kind of those are set? What among those? What are essential to you being in a space with others?
In
a
space, and when, right?
And when.
It doesn't mean I have to be there every day, right? So no. Even in mandates, sometimes I do see 3 to 4 days a week. I often ask why. And it's because it's a number that somebody just pulled up because it sounded good, right? And yeah. It's because they need, and they're practical reasons, right? They need capacity for their buildings that they're renting. Like there is real estate things that they don't want to say, but that's what it is. They're tax incentives that they got when they moved into a location or a city that they want to maintain. It's the fact that they have businesses that they own, like restaurants and stuff, that are not making as much money because there's not enough foot traffic anymore. So those are the incentives, and then they turn around and say, but this is your fault, which is one of the biggest things with employees. If you notice in most of the conversations with employees about work, it's always, this is your fault. You need to be happy. You need to be this. You need to be that. And the question is always, okay, well, what is the role of the organization in that process, right? And the organization often likes to step back, right? I think we have to get better about framing work as not the center and core of life. And I think that's a big part of it. When it's at the center and core of life, like home is sometimes at the center of core of life. So where are you? You expect to be home at a specific time. You expect to be for a certain amount of time, right? They're formulas. And so this is something that I say sometimes, and I laugh because I get these reactions. I'm like, think about it. Leaders traditionally have been given formulas. This is the formula for success, right? Even when you think about work, 8 hours at work, 8 hours at home, 8 hours of sleep, formula, right? We've just been given a formula. 5 days at work, 40-hour week, it's just a formula. This is what has been taught. This is successful. And so the leader says, oh, I'm not going to break that because this is what was successful for the person before me. This is what got me here. This is the formula. So we pass these formula downs. It's also what happens in certain universities where you find that the same people from the same universities and the same networks are always taking up the same type of jobs because there's these formulas that are constantly being passed. And ever so often, something shifts. And that's what happened in 2020. Something shifted where people started to question, but is that formula correct? And change is one of the hardest things to accept, that moving from to a skills base also recognizes that time is not the center of work. The skill is the center of work. And you'll see that's why there's some resistance to skills base, because now you're trying to find a formula with skills. What's hard? What's soft? What's necessary? And so until people could get something in their head, this is the formula, this amount of hard, this amount of soft in office, this amount of, you know what I mean? Until people could find a formula that makes them comfortable, that's why we're getting pushback on the idea. Time is easy. Time is easy to measure.
You know, it's so weird about this, because shareholder capitalism would suggest that your incentive is to get your people to perform at the greatest degree, make this money out, which is what we're talking about. However, these norms, these established cultural norms around work are not that, and yet they are as powerful a force as shareholder capitalism, which I would think shareholder capitalism would, like, I'm constantly talking about how that's a crock. Yet this is like, no. The other thing is just as powerful and quite frankly, just as messy in its apparent, you know, reality towards truth and why we're here in the first place.
Right. That's the funny thing. When you think of creating shareholder value, it should be focused on outcomes, right? Because even when I talk about employee experience, I'm like, look, I am no fool. The point of any business is to make money. That is the incentive of business, to make money, right? Shareholder value has been attached to it because we've decided to IPO organizations, cut them up. And so, again, we have created bad behaviors where we go quarter to quarter on everything instead of thinking about long-term. How do we build long-term? How do we create long-term strategies? But in doing so, you as a shareholder logically go, we made a lot of money during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. My shareholder value was so high. We did not lose productivity when people were working remotely. Why are you creating this mandate?
Yeah.
This mandate doesn't make sense. it doesn't make logical sense to shareholder value, right? So you will notice in a lot of the messaging around something like return to offices, we're not being innovative enough. And that's why we're losing market share. And it's like, that's not it. That's not it. I'll give an example. Well, not a concrete example, but you're a tech company. You're in plateau. You were like, that's just the way markets work. You're in plateau. You created. You were innovative. You were new. You were first to market. You have now plateaued. There's so much more you could do to the phone at this point. Right? It's so much smaller that you're going to make it right now. It's so much more that you can do with this product that you've created right now with a willingness to invest in it while still making all this money on it. Right? There's only so much room that you have to grow to get more profit on this thing. There's so much more you can squeeze from consumers. But instead, you've decided that we're not innovative enough because people aren't in the same room. Because what you're trying to do is send the message to shareholders that that is the problem. And so to a shareholder who's not paying attention, they're like, oh, well, let's get them back to the office then because I want more money. When if a shareholder really looks at their shareholder value during the pandemic, they're like, oh, we didn't lose any money. We made a lot of money during this period. And it balanced off some of the things we lost, like real estate value, right? But your medical stocks went up, right? So it's just one of those things.
One of the things I find fascinating about this is, so I do a lot of talks, and I was just in Milwaukee yesterday talking to a bunch of McDonald's franchisees, and the innovation idea came up, and I said, here's the thing. I speak a lot of conferences around creativity and innovation. They are not the same thing. And it's really important to understand the difference here, because you can have creativity with zero innovation. That is the norm, actually. Mostly that's a lot of people coming up with terrible ideas. That's fine.
Right,
that's
right, right.
However, you cannot have innovation without creativity. So that being the case, you need to understand that the creative process is messy. It is rife with failure. It's rapid prototyping in front of audiences. It necessitates more bad ideas than good, because we're not watching good ideas. So if you want your people to be innovative, where are you setting them up to be creative together?
Exactly. And it's the whole idea of employee experience. The employee experience is not about happiness. It's about people feeling set up for success, right? If you do decide to put them in a room and tell them, be creative, what are you giving them? What is the room that you're giving them? What is the place? Are you sending them to an island? Are you, like, what are you giving them to set them up for
giving
success?
Giving them a ping pong table?
Right. Are you giving them a nap pod? Is that what you think is going to make them creative? Are you sending them up to a mountain? And I'm like, we talk about innovative, like it's that thing that somebody just wakes up in the middle of the night. And it's because we lie. Right? Entrepreneurs lie about the process, right?
Yeah.
It is, to your point, it is rife with failure. It is rife with you looking at some of your old ideas you wrote on and say, I can't believe I came up with that thing, right? It's the reason a book has multiple drafts, right? You read that first draft and said, oh my goodness, I thought this was genius at the time, right?
And then your editor is like, not so much.
Exactly. Like, what did you do? And so I'm like, that is innovation. Innovation allows for discomfort, fast failure, and failure forgiveness, right? Are we setting that up? Then we're not talking about innovation. All we're talking about is money. All we're talking about is money. And if that's what we're talking about, okay, how do you set me up to be productive on the thing that you want me to do, right? There's a reason people were creative during the pandemic, right? I saw some of the biggest innovations and upgrades on HR tech I've ever seen happen between 2020 and 2022, right? I have seen communities built. I've seen orchestras on TikTok, right? I have seen, you know, shows change. I have seen these things happen because when people are uncomfortable, they get to really get their feet to the fire. But also when there is a flexibility that people discover, they can then tap into their creativity. When I don't have to worry about my son's health, right? I don't have to worry that there's a, you know, my son is neurodivergent, he has autism. If I don't have to worry about whether or not my job is going to let me out of the core because he has a breakdown or he has some issue in school, I have the room now in my brain to think of new ideas. And then creativity doesn't just happen in a vacuum. Innovation is nothing if it isn't said out loud, right? So mm-hmm. I need to put it on the table. I need to put it out there. I need people to shoot it down. I need people to say, oh, that's genius. I need to put it out there. What are you allowing for? What venue are you allowing for that to happen? So don't tell me about wanting everybody back in one space because you want more innovation, because all you're doing is putting them back in one space. That's it. That's not creativity. That's control. That's control.
Do I dare bring up the word culture? I'm going to. So we've interviewed a bunch of people about culture. One of the phrases I like is culture, what happens when the boss isn't around. But there's a lot of different phrases with regard to that. How do you perceive culture in these spaces? And then how do we get to what you would call a healthy culture?
For me, culture is not what's written down. It's never what's written down. Culture is what people are experiencing at the very bottom of your organization. Culture is people's day-to-day experience in the organization. The biggest thing I see in organizations is what's written down and what people are experiencing are very different. I do a lot of employee listening and I will say, oh yeah, let's measure this. This is our values. This is our employer value proposition. This is who we are. And then I do listening with the organization. They're like, that is absolutely not what I experienced in this organization, right? That is culture. That is culture. If I go to a different country to visit, what I'm experiencing day to day is their culture. That's like, I don't care what their president says. I don't care what the prime minister says. That is their culture. What they're wearing, what I'm experiencing, what I'm eating, the senses, the sounds, that is their culture. That is culture in an organization as well. If I go visit a company, what am I hearing? What am I seeing? What are they eating? What are they doing? That's culture, right? To get to a healthy culture, I think the biggest thing is we have to align what people experience day to day with what we're seeing as our culture. And yeah. One of the biggest inhibitors, I think, to healthy culture is denial. The idea that I want to put out so much performance art of culture that I'm choosing not to address culture. And again, it gets back down to that employee experience. How are you setting people in your organization up for success? If you're not setting them up for success, you are creating a toxic culture. Are you rewarding the right behaviors? So in sales, this is a big one in sales. There's somebody, they're the best salesperson, but they're the most toxic person on the planet. But you're like, they have really good sales though. Here's the problem. Everybody else is seeing what you're rewarding. The behavior yeah. that also comes with the sales. What do? You keep rewarding that behavior. So now you keep the number one salesperson, but you've lost number two, you've lost number three, you've lost number four, you've lost number five. So instead of getting all the sales from number two, three, four, five, top salespeople, you've chosen to keep one person. And now you're teaching everybody that person's ways. And that is what it is. Culture can be only fixed by what we're willing to face and what we're rewarding in the culture. And that's the hardest thing, because you got to face the uncomfortable, that this is not a good culture, that this is toxic. I love this person. They bring us a lot of money, but they are creating a problem. They will get us sued. They will make us lose people. It's facing your reality. Culture is about honesty. And that is the hard part for a lot of people to face.
And I wonder if it wouldn't be easier for all of us. So employees who are experiencing this, but leaders who are experiencing this, there is no Eden. There is no nirvana. There is no utopia. There is no place that has a perfect culture. And in fact, it is probably more common in a business that you have pockets of good culture and pockets of bad culture. There's no way to control this. It's just impossible. These are human beings in groups, in small groups, bigger groups, whatever. So you're always going to be playing a bit of whack-a-mole. And if we all understand that, maybe the temperature is lowered enough to have some more honest conversations that allow things not to flare so much either direction. I don't know.
Right. No, I think this is what I think is the biggest misconception we have about work and the employee experience. And this has been our biggest problem. We ask people to be happy at work.
Yeah.
That is, I think, the biggest problem. Everybody's searching for this holy grail of happiness at work. When I talk about employee experience, people are always surprised when I say that has nothing to do with happiness. You said it had something to do with happiness. That's not happiness. happiness is how I feel, and it's subjective, and I don't need to get my happiness from work. What you're describing is satisfaction. What you're describing is that feeling of being set up for success, and I can do my work and I can be productive. That's the thing you're describing, but then you're asking me to be happy. So what's happening is you're expecting me to do a survey, for example, or talk to your employees, and you want everybody to be giddy. So you take them on retreats. You want them to yell. You want to see people running around and laughing. But I'm like, happiness needs to be decentered from the idea of what work is. Happiness in a good workplace is a really good side effect, but it should not be the holy grail, because it puts this incentive on people to feel that thing. And when they're not feeling it, they don't know what to do. And that creates work trauma and workplace disillusionment. That creates toxic behaviors, because what we're doing is this appearance of happiness, but it's not about happiness. It never was supposed to be about happiness. And I tell people, the reason why we have doubled down on this idea that you should be happy on work, because organizations a long time ago told people they need to be loyal. Well, if you need me to bend the knee to you and be completely loyal to you, then you need to make me happy. You need to make me feel that emotion, that joy. But that's not fair, right? It's work. And I think until we realize it's work, and we could decenter it as the center of our lives and still like our job, and we could then get to the point where I'll never always be happy. And even if I'm happy, I could be happy today, but I do not have to be happy tomorrow. We don't need the same consistent behavior. I could be 100% today, 70% tomorrow, 50% on Wednesday, and then I could be 100% again. And that's okay. That's the human experience of work. And I could be productive at all times, right? I think that's the problem. We've created this holy grail of happiness, right? And I can go with my kids and be happy. I could go eat food and be happy. I could go play with my pets and be happy. And then I could go to work, do my work, feel satisfied that I have done a good day's work, and go back home and feel happy. You know what I mean?
I had never really thought about this, you know, terrible trade between loyalty and happiness as being like the worst deal with the devil, sort of like Goethe's Faust, that this is like, it's not going to work out for anyone. It was an exchange that was wrong in the first place, and the presuppositions were in error, and it wasn't, and you're right. I mean, because, and this is also coming from someone who, again, I've worked here for forever, my entire adult life, started when I was 21, and get great satisfaction out of work. Have I been happy here? I've been happy in the building. I've been sad.
Right. Some days, right.
All those different things, but the joy is beyond all of that. Okay. All right. In a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story. Before we do that, there's one area that I actually sent one of your lines from the book around to a couple of my colleagues here. And this is around businesses that undergo transformations. And I work at one of those places that's sort of like seemingly always having transformations. You say, quote, if you lead an organization that is constantly in transformation, I have some advice for you. Land the plane. Just land it. You keep circling around the airport aimlessly, and it's starting to affect your passengers, end quote.
That is. And that's how I feel. I've been in so many organizations. I've consulted for so many organizations. And because transformation allows for a how do I say this nicely? A lack of accountability, right? That's the problem. Because you're always in idea mode, right? Which is supposed to be the fun stuff, right? You're always in idea mode. And if I land the plane, I'm accountable for the landing, right? Yeah. But if I keep flying, then maybe I can just keep passing the buck around. But I tell people, think about work is we do the most absurd things when it comes to work. But when you take it and take that same situation and put it in real life, everybody knows that this is absurd. So I tell people, if I was flying on a plane and I'm heading to Florida, that's why I got on the plane for. I'm going to Florida. Everybody says we're going to Florida. So that's where we're going. And then somewhere, pilot makes an announcement. Hey, y'all, I think we're going to Hawaii. Okay. So just letting y'all know, we're heading to Hawaii now. As a passenger, I'm like, I have plans in Florida. What are we doing? We planned everything for Florida. That's like another 8 hours. What are you talking about? Then on the way to Hawaii, they go, change my mind, think we're going to head to Japan. At some point, everybody's going to panic and say, get me off this plane. Something is wrong with the pilot. But at work, we never say something is wrong with the pilot, right? No. Instead, we say something's wrong with the passengers for reacting that way. And that's why I'm like, land the plane. Accept if there's going to be success or failure. But flying it around all that time, all you're going to do is have anxious, angry, traumatized people. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't work. It doesn't make the airline any more money. In fact, you might have to pay me out.
Yeah. I love it. All right. We always end the podcast with a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
I do have a yes answer. So this one is a bit convenient, but it's my book. I was thinking about it. So my husband had been telling me for a long time, I should write things down, right? I should write it down. I'm like, I'm not writing them down. I'm not that interested. And he was like, you should write it down. So there was this one day, this group from, I can't remember which country in Africa it is. It keeps missing me. I want to say it's Cape Town. They asked me to present an employee experience because they said they didn't really know a whole lot about it. And they happened to see something on my LinkedIn profile. And I was like, I'm not that interesting. I don't know that much about it, but I'll do it. So I went and I gave them this whole webinar about employee experience and talked about it. It was one of the first times I had just talked about it and gave this whole presentation on it. And at the end of that webinar, they started to ask me questions, where can I get this information? And I sat there and realized, I don't know. This was in my head. Yeah. This is from my experience.
Yeah.
And then this was my second yes. They're like, can you create something? And then I said, I guess I can. And that was an uncomfortable situation for me.
Yeah.
Right. Like even that talk I did that day was uncomfortable for me because it took me, like I told you before, it took me a while to find my voice. I always in my career, I used to shrink, right? I didn't want to be too smart. I didn't want to be perceived a certain type of way. So I'd shrink. This was one of the first times I said, okay, I'm a step to the front, right? I'll step to the front. I'll talk. So then I did that. And it led to me doing videos. It led to me getting more speaking opportunities. It led to the book. Because eventually, everything that I started talking about, and my husband still laughs to this day, he said, I told you, write it down. And I wrote it all down. And here I am. Here I'm with you. And here's where life took me in a direction I never considered. All because I think that random request one day on LinkedIn to speak to a group on the other side of the Atlantic about something that I just didn't know that I knew so well in that moment. So that was my yes.
I love that. And the reason you're really with me here today was our friend Steve, who I used
yes.
to be a colleague here, sent me a text. He's like, you have to talk to this person. And, you know, I have so many, I mean, I'm booked through like the spring in terms of guests here. And I'm sorry, I'm saying no so much. And this was like, I can't say no to this. I will not say no to this because it's my friend and I didn't know anything about you. And now you're my new hero. So this is like a great yes and for all of us. The book is called I Think I Love My Job, Secrets to Designing a People-Centered Employer Value Proposition that you can actually boast about. Khalifa Oliver, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it so much.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
survives 10 million feet.
Survive.